This is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop. Yeah, stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me, gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and raw. Here is Steve Gruber.
And welcome to a free-for-all Friday edition of the program. Steve Gruber with you. The phone number to join the conversation, 888-900-9966, 888-900-9966. Takes a lot to bring this program to you every day. It's a great team I have the pleasure of working with. The team is getting larger, which is good. The demands of 17 stations getting more than it was when it was a few, and I appreciate your support that has helped us to grow this way. Coming Monday, WLCO Lapeer signs on, our latest addition to the team here. We also need the sponsors, Ryan's Roadhouse in St. John's, Michigan, a great supporter of the program. Ryan's Roadhouse, something different. Great craft beers from all over the state of Michigan. Salmon to die for, and the food in general. And it's a real roadhouse. I mean, if you have a road king and you want to go wheel that in, that's a place to be, a soft tail, that sort of thing. If you have just an old pickup truck like mine, the Roadhouse. You ever been there?
No, I'm not.
Well, what are you doing? Get out of here. Go up there and check it out. I've been telling you.
Let me see what time is it. They're not open yet.
Well, they could be. It's a roadhouse. You never know about it. Probably not. Ryan's Roadhouse, thank you for the support here on the program. The hotline number, 888-900-9966. He was a racist. He was a racist. Simply put, that the description given to the killer at the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston. And I've made a decision to join some other news outlets to not use this killer's name, because it doesn't advance the story. It doesn't advance the story in any way, and you can find it a variety of places, but you're not going to get it here because I'm not going to give him the notoriety that he wanted. I'm going to skip that altogether. It's time to say this is a killer and a pig and a violent, bloodthirsty animal. They shall remain nameless, and will likely find his last moments at the death chamber of South Carolina. They still have I mentioned this earlier. South Carolina, interestingly enough, is one of four states that has the electric chair readily available. A couple of states, Tennessee and Kentucky, I think you can use the electric chair if you're convicted before a certain time, you know, that predates lethal injection, whatnot. You know, but lethal injection drugs are almost impossible to get these days because the company that makes one in the UK is refusing to send them to the United States because they perform death penalties with them. And if that's the case, well, then Old Sparky, as they call pretty much all of them, except Yellowbird. I think Yellowbird's one in Florida, maybe. At any rate, created by Thomas Edison, if you didn't know this, Thomas Edison was a believer in direct current, not alternating current. Just a little side note for you, a little education. And Tesla said that alternating current was the future, and Edison was in a big war with Tesla. He said, no, it's not. AC is dangerous. It'll kill people. So he constructed the electric chair to show people how dangerous AC was. And as a result, he got horrible press. Thomas Edison got horrible press for creating this horrible device that would kill people. But then the states looked at it and said, oh, you can kill people with that. Can we buy one of those? Anyhow, so since 1912, specifically since 1912, many states have used the electric chair. And a couple of states you can still get the, if you're so inclined, I think there are two states where you can still get the firing squad if you're so inclined.
Yeah, I think there is. Is Utah one?
Utah is one.
And I can't remember the other, but
I think it's Montana. Montana might be one where you have the firing squad now. But Utah, yeah, Gary Gilmore, 1976, the first guy put to death in this country after the moratorium on the death penalty was lifted by the United States Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And he faced a firing squad, and his last words were, let's do it. Which some contend led to the Nike slogan of just to do it. I mean, that's really it's a true story on the
internet. I think that's probably a stretch.
True story on the internet.
A lot of states.
See what I said? It's a true story on the internet.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Hanging is a.
You can still do that some places.
It's usually the.
And what's the method here in Michigan?
There is no method in Michigan. There, it was the first Western government to ban executions.
I think it might be the only state that has, in fact, never. Death penalty has never been allowed since Michigan became a state. There was one execution in Michigan after statehood was initiated.
By the federal government.
Federal government. You got it. Federal execution. Anyhow, so back to this guy in Charleston. He's an avowed racist. Apparently, he sat in this Bible study for, an hour or something, talking to these, visiting a little bit anyhow, and then said, I have to do this because you're raping our women and, taking over our society or some ridiculous
strange thing. Because, they were older women sitting there that are obviously not raping anybody.
Yeah, the oldest victim, an 87-year-old woman. I mean, so obviously, this is a deranged individual and what we're gathering here are some commonalities with previous serial killers, which is a heavy use of prescription drugs, isolation from what I'll refer to as normal society, a heavy focus on violent video games. All of these things, you've got to say, listen, there is a common denominator here of mental health and these violent video games desensitizing these people. And I don't know who trained him, because it seems, a 21-year-old man that is this, dyed-in-the-wool racist. He was wearing, apartheid South African flags on his jacket and so forth, and had apparently had a long history of making racially divisive remarks in school and on Facebook and so forth. This didn't just happen. I mean, he wasn't born, he was created by something.
I'm sure as this goes on, his parents, and especially his father, are going to show that this is where he learned it from, probably.
Yeah,
there'll be a lot of analysts, just like everything else.
It'll be overanalyzed, just like everything else. Possibility. All right, let me switch gears here for a second, because here on the Hill, a story moving on the Hill this morning, which is one of the sources, and trust me, we read a ton of material here. It might be time for Hillary Clinton to take the challenge from Bernie Sanders a little more seriously. The avowed communist socialist from Vermont, Sanders surging in the race for the party's presidential nomination. No joke. The Vermont Independent has drawn huge crowds of supporters in Iowa and New Hampshire and pulled within striking distance of Clinton in some Granite State polls. No joke, in New Hampshire. This is not a protest campaign, Sanders declared at a breakfast with the reporters in Washington last week. This is a campaign to win. He is also a powerful presence on social media, where supporters are eager to share his campaign and news about his campaign and talk about and tout Bernie Sanders. While Clinton remains a runaway favorite, the strength of the Sanders challenge, particularly in the states hosting the first two contests, Iowa and New Hampshire, is getting attention now. Primary voters in New Hampshire are looking around, said a strategist. They at least want to shop around a bit before buying. They want to know what else is on the shelf. Based on that alone, it is probably time for Clinton to engage and take Sanders seriously. One of the problems that the Sanders surge poses for Clinton is that Democrats say there's a risk in taking him head on. Good job, Bernie Sanders, and welcome to the race. 14 after on a free-for-all Friday on the Steve Gruber Show.
This is the Steve Gruber Show, bringing you the news and newsmakers that affect you most.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends. I can't wait to get on
18 after the hour. Time to check in with our good friend Derek Blaylock. He's riding his bicycle across America, bringing attention to Tommy's Heart. It's the Bike for Tommy's Heart effort. Out there, if you haven't heard this story yet, and Derek's been on with us two or three times now, Derek's riding from South Carolina all the way across the country to Los Angeles and back again across the country to raise awareness. His friend Tommy died from a sudden cardiac event when I think he was 17 years old. And the point is that a lot of these student athletes go through this, it's like a cursory health check before they play basketball, football, soccer, softball, whatever it might be. And it doesn't really detect potentially deadly flaws with their heart. Derek, welcome back to the program, my friend.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
So how you holding up? Have you lost more weight? Are you eating enough? How is it going out there?
It's going well. My legs are feeling a little bit, feeling good a little bit, and I'm stopped in Colorado Springs, Colorado, right now for a couple days. Tonight, I'm throwing out the first pitch at the minor league baseball team I worked with out here for 8 months last year.
Terrific.
So I'll be back out on the road Sunday morning, but. It's nice to have a little break.
Just think about that already, though. I mean, and for listeners, think about this. He's written from, where'd you start in South Carolina? Where'd you start?
Charleston, South Carolina. Right, then I went up to New York before I started coming west.
Right. But you've ridden all the way from Charleston to Colorado Springs and, you know, north and then back across. I mean, what a ride. Do you know how many miles you've logged already?
I think it's about 2,800.
It's just a little ride around the park.
Yeah.
So how many miles until you get to Los Angeles? Another 1,500? What is it?
I think it's roughly about 800 or so, maybe a little more.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah.
Heck, you're almost there. You know. Anyhow.
Yeah,
so. What's been the most interesting thing this last week that you found across America?
I've met a lot of interesting people this last week. A lot of great people who've donated to the cause at some of the campgrounds we've stayed at. We put up our banners and they just walk over and start a conversation with me or my mom. And
sure,
it's really interesting. So, and I think in the last week, I know a girl in Kansas City passed away, and a boy in Fort Collins, Colorado, died of sudden cardiac arrest. So, and yesterday in St. Louis, another kid also passed away. So three kids in a week, maybe a week and a half. So it really
preventable deaths, and that's
why
the thing.
We're doing this.
Yeah, preventable deaths, which is what you're trying to draw attention to, and how sad is that? But, you know, if you ride, maybe you save the next three.
Yeah,
and that's the point. Maybe you save the next three, Derek. All right, so you're off on your way. Real quickly, tell the listeners again where they can get involved and, you know, put some money into your coffers to help prevent what you just described.
Yeah, you guys can go support me at bikefortommyheart.com. Or you GoFundMe / Bike for Tommy's Heart. And I'm also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
There you go. All right. Ride like the wind, my friend. And we'll touch base with you again next week.
Thank you, sir.
There you have it. Derek Blaylock, everybody. He's ridden, 2,800 miles already? Holy moly. He'll be built like a brick, to say the least. Yeah, that microphone, you need that thing to actually communicate.
He has, and according to his predictions, he's not even halfway yet.
Well, no, because he has to go. It's like one of those things. You got to go run all the way down there, touch the wall, and then run all the way back. You know, like coaches used to do to you when you're in high school sports.
Touch the line. Touch the line.
I remember a coach said, "All right, it's two-a-days. It's hotter than a blowtorch out there. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to crab walk over to that school over there. So it's about 500 yards away. And when we get there, we get a big drink of water and we'll crab back." Well, it's one of those taps on the outside of the building that needs a key. He goes, "Ah, I don't have a key for the water, guys. I guess we'll just crab back." You know what I'm talking about.
The life of a lineman.
Yeah. Michigan State archaeologists here in Michigan completely ruled out the possibility of a Lake Michigan shipwreck, that being the long-lost Griffin. There was some thought that this might be the long-lost Griffin, which, Shane, why is that significant?
Well, the Griffin, it was disappeared approximately September 1679, but those dates are really important. This was a French area. The Great Lakes region was all French, and it was developed because of furs, correct?
That'd be correct.
Everybody's been to Mackinac Island knows about that.
The fur industry,
but
sure.
The fur industry. Because they were transporting by canoes prior to that, because they couldn't get around the falls, Niagara specifically, no canals, no anything.
Right.
This was the first wooden ship built in the Great Lakes.
I got you. So because you couldn't get up the St. Lawrence Seaway and so forth.
Couldn't get around the
Niagara Falls, yeah.
Couldn't get out of the falls. And you also couldn't get into Lake Superior because of the rapids in St. Mary's River.
Sure.
So this ship went out and was collecting furs. They know it got to a couple of locations because they collected the furs, and it was never heard from again. So to find that ship is going to be almost impossible because there was no kind of documentation, no communications in those days as to where it would have been located when it went out.
All right. Well, there you go. Perfect. And, you know, if we could find that ship, that'd be interesting. But it'd be just an interesting thing. This is not the Griffin they found, by the way. That became official just a couple of days ago.
Because it had some mechanical parts to it.
Had parts that were not historically consistent with September 1679. A lot of shipwrecks in the Great Lakes. So it's summertime, so the divers are going to be out there and looking for such things. Thanks, Shane, for the history lesson. That's why we call him Cletus. No, that's not why we call him Cletus. That's a different reason. It's 25 after the hour. It's Free for All Friday. You can join the conversation. 888-900-9966. Just kind of letting our hair down a little bit. Shane letting his hair down a lot farther than my own. 888-900-9966 is 25 after on a Free for All Friday.
Michigan's radio program of record is The Steve Gruber Show. Here is Steve Gruber.
Mother, tell your children not to walk my way.
33 after the hour now on a Free for All Friday.
What they mean, what they
phone number here is 888-900-9966. Bring your common sense. 888-900-9966. Bring your common sense. Our next guest here is Chief Dan Roberts from the Franklin Bingham Farms Police Department. Just to look into some of the big stories making news this week. One being the escaped killers from New York and the Shawshank Redemption escape of the century. We'll look for that to be a Hollywood movie at some point. Gone for 2 weeks now. We'll get to that one. And of course, just a couple of days ago, the murder of nine people at a Bible study in Charleston, South Carolina, and the killer involved there. Chief Dan Roberts with us now. Chief, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be back with you, Steve.
Good to be back with you, sir. And, you know, you look at this 21-year-old killer, and I've decided with some other news organizations, I'm not going to use his name, you know, because I think that it just perpetuates this idea that they can be famous or infamous, as it were. And so I'm going to skip that. But a 21-year-old killer who, if you look at the pictures, man, he's disturbing to look at, and he's an avowed racist, and this really is a hate crime, no matter how you would try to, you know, parse it out. And I just asked myself, how do we get to this point, and how does a police department defend against? I mean, he's not the only one. There's people like this that walk among us every day, unfortunately, but I don't know if there's much you can do to defend against it.
Well, you know, I'm a police chief now, but in my prior life, I was with the FBI for 25 years. And one of the things that we always struggled with in the FBI was doing all the gun check process, which they do for the country. And part of that gun check process is a mental health check question. And frankly, it's lacking in terms of its substance. I mean, basically, you're at the whim of the person who's purchasing a firearm to declare or not that he or she has had mental illness in the past. And so it's a real challenge for law enforcement to figure out, you know, who should be getting firearms, and should somebody who's clearly mentally unstable and have a long, detailed history of that be allowed to get a firearm? And that's the challenge. But the challenge is, you know, where do you draw that line then? Is it somebody that just has a very mild form of, say, depression or something? Should they not get a firearm? Or should it, should it be somebody like this gentleman who obviously has a troubled past, and many of his friends and associates are coming forward now afterwards to talk about his troubled past? I mean, if you ask me, that is the discussion that needs to be had in Washington, and how do we find a way that we can identify these people with mental health issues and, you know, at least attempt to deny them from purchasing a firearm. And that's where the challenge comes in.
Yeah, you know, and I'm looking at this, and I think it's likely. I was disappointed. I won't kid you. Dan, that the president came out and politicized this very quickly. I don't think it's time for that, for politicizing this quite yet, but I think something comes to the forefront here. My understanding from reading these stories, and maybe you can shed some light on this as well. My understanding, though, is that his father gave him this .45 caliber handgun for his birthday sometime recently, right? So here come those that are, you know, anti-gun people are going to say, listen, if there had been a background check and the transfer of that firearm from his father to his son, maybe we could have prevented this, because he is already jammed up with possession charges with drugs, some other issues with trespassing. He's already jammed up on some other stuff. Maybe he never would have gotten the gun if they'd filled out the yellow sheet.
But that's probably not the case, because as far as I know, just based on media reports, he hasn't been convicted of a felony that would prohibit him from owning a firearm. You have to have a felony conviction or a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, or have a obvious history of mental illness where you have had involuntary committal type of situation. So even with a standardized FBI background check, he probably would have gone through, just based on what I know on media reports. And obviously, I'm not...
I appreciate that, because, I mean, that brings a good spotlight. But make no mistake, Dan, what I just said is exactly what you'll hear from the left. That's exactly, they'll say, well, you know, if we'd done a background check, this wouldn't have happened. If we could just close these loopholes, this wouldn't happen. Yeah. But you just, I mean, again, you were with the FBI for 25 years. You understand the background check procedures probably as well as anybody that's ever been on this program. And you just laid out for us what we have currently in place is pretty, pretty extensive.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't have stopped this.
That's likely correct. And keep in mind, too, the numbers that the FBI processes in terms of background checks on these are well over 20 million a year. You know, so you're talking about a small fraction. I mean, it's so infinitesimal, you can't even talk about the decimal numbers involved in one person out of 22, 23 million that are involved in purchasing. You know, so the vast majority, obviously, are lawful gun owners that are going and buying these guns. But the politicians are loath to take on this mental health issue, because there are so many HIPAA laws and privacy issues concerned with regard to mental health and doctor visits and everything, even though there are probably people out there who know about certain individuals who have mental health issues that shouldn't have guns.
Well, you know, it's unfortunate. If you go back, it all started in the mid-1950s, the closing of America's mental health facilities. And it began with lawsuits from the American Civil Liberties Union against the mental health facilities in California, and then spread across the country. For example, I was talking to somebody here a couple of days ago, and they said, well, the prison in Marshall. I didn't realize there was a prison in Marshall, Michigan. Well, I said, yeah, it used to be the mental health facility there, and they turned it into a prison. Well, you know, if we'd turned some of our prisons back into mental health facilities, Dan, you know, maybe there'd be a possibility of, you know, but we didn't want to label anybody. We didn't want, you know, ACLU didn't want anybody to get their feelings hurt. So you're right, the mental health capacity and the way we used to take care of people, just it isn't the same as it was years ago.
That is true, and now, unfortunately, it's up to, you know, the people that run our prisons and jails and other detention facilities now end up becoming those that are in charge of mental health, people that have mental health problems, because at some point they're going to commit a crime and they're going to end up in one of these prisons, and then, you know, you basically, that's where your mental health education and everything else is coming right now, is in prisons, and that's unfortunate.
And talking about politicizing it, I'll say the people on the right have politicized this already as well, which I think is unfortunate. You know, churches are a gun-free zone. You know what? Again, guys, maybe we can talk about these things after these people have been laid to rest, after their families have had a moment to breathe and to grieve, before we have the president on one side saying it's time for gun control and people on the right saying it's time to allow guns into churches. Maybe we should take a moment and step back, or maybe I'm wrong. I don't know, Dan.
Yeah, this is a debate that's been raging on for years, and it's kind of a religious debate, really, when you think about it, and it's hard to change people's views on that, and I've certainly seen both sides of it in my time in 30-plus years in law enforcement, but the fact of the matter is, like I said, the vast, vast majority of those that are seeking to purchase and carry guns are good, honest citizens, just want to do that. But the issue, in my view, is, you know, this mental health issue is, how do you identify those and report those individuals who have mental health issues that really rise to the level that they should be denied a firearm?
And that's
the challenge.
Part of the challenge, no question. Dan Roberts on the line with us. He is the police chief at the Franklin Bingham Farms Police Department in Southeast Michigan, also a 25-year veteran of the FBI. Now, if you could hold the line, Dan, we're going to talk more about these two escapees from New York, 2 weeks now into this search for these guys who are cold-blooded killers and some say the face of evil. Dan Roberts here on the program. It's Free for All Friday on the Steve Gruber Show. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Steve Gruber Show. Get the news and information vital to your world.
All right, welcome back to this free-for-all Friday edition of the Steve Gruber Show. If you'd like to join the conversation, the Common Sense Hotline is 888-900-9966, 888-900-9966. On the line is Dan Roberts. He's the Chief of Police in Franklin Bingham Farms. He's also a 25-year veteran of the FBI, where he ran the FBI's fugitive program. So let's get to the fun part of the day. I guess, Dan, for me, it's fun, and it's because it's interesting to think that these guys could break out of prison. I'm not saying it's fun that two killers got away or are still out on the loose 2 weeks later, but it is interesting to conceive of the kind of planning and luck and skill, if you will, that it took to escape a maximum security prison in the state of New York and still be gone 2 weeks later.
It makes for a great story. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, I'm sure there will be, you know, made-for-television movies and all kinds of things later on done about these two guys. But, you know, the fact of the matter is the FBI's been investigating issues involving prisons for a long time. And most of the time it doesn't rise to this kind of level. But, you know, I can think of countless cases where drugs, for example, have been smuggled into the prisons or other kinds of paraphernalia. And often that involves, unfortunately, some kind of insider inside those prisons that was helping them. And that's clearly what's happened in this case as well.
So, okay, I mean, you did this for a long time. You pursued fugitives, and I'm going to say you usually got your man. This is 2 weeks in, and you know, there have been several things suggested. My brother on the program suggested maybe they got on, maybe it wasn't a car, maybe they had a bicycle that they could get outside the ring of focus. Maybe it was another way because their driver, apparently, the woman that had a panic attack and didn't fulfill her idea of picking them up and giving them a ride, but they still got out of that circle. At least that's my guess, or maybe I don't know.
Well, it could be. You know, heck, they could have jumped on a cargo train. They could have done anything to get away from there. There's no doubt about that. But the fact is that sooner or later they're going to screw up. They can't be out there on their own for very long without any sort of money to sustain them. So they're going to have to do something to get that money, whether they commit more crimes or break into houses and steal the money, however it is, or have support from family, friends, or something like that. So at some point, they're going to need money to survive, and they're going to screw up, and they're going to either get caught doing another crime, or somebody who's aiding and abetting them, a friend, family, associate, is going to screw up and bring them assistance. And that's where the FBI and all of the other, the marshals and every other, 600-plus law enforcement officers that are involved are going to be watching for is what are these unexplained crimes in the area, and also what are the friends, family, and associates up to, because that's what they'll be looking at.
So that's what your gut tells you, watch the friends, family, and associates. Is it possible, I mean, there have been suggestions, these guys could already be in Mexico or wherever.
It certainly is possible. I mean, I know they would want to get as far away from that area. But, you know, like, for example, the FBI chases organized crime figures for years. And if you look at one publicized case, Whitey Bulger, for example, who was on the top 10 list for ages, you know, seemed like, what was it, 20 years. Sooner or later, he screwed up. Now, it took a long time, but he did screw up. And somebody figured it out and called in on a tip, and that's how we ended up making the arrest on him. Hopefully, this certainly doesn't take that long. These guys are going to be much more desperate. Obviously, Whitey Bulger was well-funded. He was able to sustain himself that long by himself. These guys don't have those kinds of resources, and so they're going to need funding. They're going to need a way to eat and sleep and do that and buy clothing and shelter and things. And so the only way to do that is I don't see them going to McDonald's and getting a job. They're likely going to do more crimes to get the money that they need.
Yeah, I'm not seeing that either. All right, so Are these guys more likely to stay fugitives if they go to some rural area out in the middle of nowhere, or if they go to, say, Los Angeles and blend in a huge city with, you know, millions of people? Where's a better place to hide?
You know, there's a lot of debate about that, but I would say the better place to hide is in a major city, because, you know, the neighbors out there in the rural areas are going to know who belongs and who doesn't, and they're going to
just like the lady that called in the fugitive from the Charleston shooting yesterday. You know, if there's somebody here that doesn't belong, looks like the guy from TV, bam, he's in custody in 5 minutes.
Right, exactly.
So, you know, go blend in a big city. And I suppose if you're talking about you have to lead a life of crime to hide from your life of crime, in effect, Dan, then right. A big city, you know, you can get away with more crime because, you know, you pick pockets, you steal a purse, you do whatever to survive, to get the bare necessities, right. You know, and who's going to catch you?
Right, right. And I think their chances are much better in a big city in doing that. But that said, these guys are going to screw up, and they're going to make a call to somebody that they shouldn't, you know, some friend or family, or they're going to arrange a meeting that they shouldn't, or hopefully some really good citizen out there sees them and calls the tip line and reports that's where they are. And that's right now, that's likely the best avenue in terms of actually solving this case, is having the public involved in getting tips. And I know that they are running 24-hour tip lines there, and they've had some really good leads, but so far nothing on that.
You still have friends that are working there, I take it.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, they're putting a lot of resources on this, but it's very difficult. These are very challenging cases when these guys are, running underneath the radar, and they're able to get away as quickly as they did. And clearly they had time to plan this out as well, and it was very sophisticated and very well done on their part. And like I said at the beginning, it's a good made-for-TV movie, and I'm sure somebody will do that at some point.
I'm sure. Yeah, I bet it. You can take that straight to the bank, no question. And Dan, I greatly appreciate your time. I guess I'm going to stick with your prediction, and your prediction is being that at some point they're going to screw up and they're going to get cuffed. And now I wonder if they'll be taken alive. A couple of these, I mean, these are rough characters, no question. But Dan, I appreciate your time.
Yep, my pleasure. Anytime.
All right, talk to you soon. Chief Dan Roberts there from the Franklin Bingham Farms Police Department in southeastern Michigan, just on the north side of Detroit there. And but also a 25-year FBI man who ran the fugitive program in Washington. I mean, he knows the topic well. Great guest, to say the least. Great guest. And again, it takes a team of great people to put these folks on the air every day right here on the Steve Gruber Show. It's Friday. We'll be back to wrap things up in a moment.